Joseph Laycock teaches an honors course in demonic possession and exorcism. We're taking a scholarly approach to this fascinating subject, and when we come back, we'll talk about things like ghost sickness and even demonic themes in popular music. Of course, we're all familiar with the legend of Robert Johnson at the crossroads, and even Bob Dylan, who ushered us back in from the break, Times Have Changed, is rumored to have admitted that he too made a deal with the devil. We'll explore all that and much more when Coast to Coast continues right after this. Joseph Laycock is with us, editor of Spirit Possession Around the World, Possession, Communion, Demonic Expulsion Across Cultures. I was talking about, before the break, about popular music and tales of demonic possession. And of course, we're all familiar with Robert Johnson. And there are many stories throughout the history of the Delta Blues that involve the crossroads and so forth. It's not just Robert Johnson, correct? I mean, there are a lot of those types of stories in that culture, in that era.
That's right. And I you know, one of the students in the course did a really wonderful paper on Robert Johnson and the Robert Johnson legend. And there's a couple of factors that play into this. Of course, one is the absolute poverty of the Mississippi Delta. This is a place where you might want to think about selling your soul to the devil as a way to get out. But also, a lot of people have made a connection between the idea in that culture that the devil meets you at a crossroads, and figures from West Africa, the West African gods that were brought to the New World through the Atlantic slave trade. And so gods like Legba are gods of the crossroads, and they're not necessarily evil the way that the Christian devil is evil, but they can be trickster figures, right? So you go to the crossroads and make a deal. It may not work out just the way that you want it to. Another really interesting insight people have brought up is that for whatever else these legends may be about figures like Robert Johnson, they kind of reflect the experience of being a black sharecropper in the 1920s, right? So slavery was over, but if you want to work, you got to make these contracts, and those contracts probably aren't going to be in your best interest. You may not even be able to read them. And if you break the contract or you try to leave, you might actually get not hellhounds, but actual dogs searching for you. So those legends may have spoke to people living in that time.
And what about stories where actual musical instruments are being portrayed as a vessel for demonic possession? For example, like Igor Stravinsky, the great violinist.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of stories of course, the violin especially. I don't know how it got its sort of association with magic that you see in stories like Charlie Daniels' The Devil Went Down to Georgia. But in a lot of cultures, possession is strongly associated with music, right? In cultures where they try to induce a state of possession by various gods and spirits, music and rhythm is one of the most common ways of doing that. So I could imagine some people hearing a really compelling violin performance and getting the feeling that something's trying to come into their mind from the outside.
In more contemporary times, a number of artists, Alice Cooper, Black Sabbath, have been very sort of overt about sort of embracing the occult and incorporating it into their stage act and so forth. But then there are artists who have had not necessarily such an overt relationship with the occult, relationships with people like Aleister Crowley and so forth. What do you make of that?
Well, I think that musicians and rock stars are very kind of artistic people. I think they have a lot of free time to explore things that maybe the rest of us couldn't think about. So I'm not surprised when I hear about rock stars having interest in the occult. We just lost David Bowie, and of course people have found all sorts of clues in some of his videos that he was interested in Freemasonry and occultism. So those kinds of symbols come out in their music and in their performances all over the place if you know where to look. And there's kind of become a cottage industry on YouTube of trying to spot a cult or so-called Illuminati symbols in contemporary videos.
You constantly see at MTV Awards and the Grammys and so forth, various artists, flashing the devil horns and so forth. And this has led to, of course, rumors that, as you mentioned, that there may be some, dark force at work behind their career, whether it's the Illuminati or whether, in fact, they've made a deal with the devil. And some artists have actually hinted that was the case. Do you think that this is all just part of sort of showmanship, or do you think there may be something to that?
I think it's probably 90% showmanship. I mean, I think it's very interesting that it always seems like you have the demonic rock star or musician on one side, and then the sort of moral majority, the pastors and the teachers and the PTA on the other, and their enemies. But really, if you look a little closer, they're actually working together, right? Because when I come out and say, this album is demonic, it's got messages from the devil if you play it backwards, of course everyone goes out and buys the album, right? And in the same way, these musicians know that if they can make the right moves, work the right cymbals into their performance, they can get condemned, they can give people something to get up on a soapbox about, and so it's kind of a game where everybody wins. Now, having said that, there clearly are cases where musicians do have a casual interest in the occult, or figures like Aleister Crowley as well, but I don't really lose sleep over that. I don't think that's going to turn the world upside down.
Talk to me about ghost sickness. This is an idea that at one time at least was sort of prevalent in certain Native American, Native Canadian cultures, the Navajo, for example. What is ghost sickness?
Yeah, so ghost sickness is the idea that when someone dies, their spirit can cling to you, but can become attached to you, and that this can cause physical symptoms to your body. You may get sick or get fever, or even have seizures. You may have nightmares and so forth. And so one thing that's interesting when you're looking at possession across cultures is that possession can mean a lot of different things, right? We tend in our culture to think of possession as being like The Exorcist, right, where you're shouting dirty words and your head is spinning around and you're shooting, pea soup all over the room. But in a lot of cultures, it can be just you get sick, and that's interpreted as this doesn't mean you have germs in your body making you sick, but the spirit is doing this to you. And so ghost sickness is one of these ideas. And so there are practices in certain Native American cultures to kind of stop the spirits from doing this, to make it so they won't latch on to people. So, for example, the Kwakiutl is a tribe from British Columbia, and they would dress their children up as adults during funerals, because there's an idea that the person who just died might be looking for someone alive to attach to, and children are so young and vital. So you dress the kid up like an old person, and that's going to trick the spirit, and it'll just move on to wherever it's supposed to go without causing ghost sickness.
There's also, kind of a negative energy that some people are very susceptible to, or at least they appear to be. They maintain that they are sensitive to that. Is there a connection between, for example, depression, substance abuse, what some people say is negative energy that they attract, and perhaps either spirit attachment, which the Navajos and others called ghost sickness, or demonic possession?
Right. So, this really comes down to how you want to interpret these symptoms. And so there are some deliverance ministers who will say basically anything bad that happens to you in your life is the result of a particular demon, right? So there's a book called Pigs in the Parlor that has a whole map of basically anything that can go wrong with your day, including, getting acne or procrastination, or just feeling kind of down in the dumps, and each one of these they would say is a demon, right? Other people would take just the opposite approach and say there are no demons. Everything that you think is a demon is actually just chemicals and neurons moving around in your brain. And so this is why I think it's so interesting, right? We've looked at cultures across history trying to make sense of what's happening to people when they're severely depressed, right? So the idea of a spirit latching onto you is a pretty good model for what's going on. And, you know, we act like we know exactly what causes depression, but we really don't. And so that can be just as effective a way of thinking about it as others. And some psychiatrists have even said that for primitive cultures or for people in the developing world who don't have access to psychiatrists and drugs for depression, that spiritual remedies can actually be very effective. So this all, you know, comes down to what you personally believe is happening when someone experiences these symptoms.
The television landscape, it's just littered with, I would say, I don't know, I'm 50% at least, I would say, especially on cable, seems to be preoccupied with the occult or the paranormal. What do you think, what does that say about society right now? Is that a healthy thing?
I don't think it's unhealthy. I haven't seen any evidence of that, but I do think that, you know, television and the popularity of these shows is something that people in religious studies should pay attention to, because I do think this is becoming an important part of the religious landscape, right? You know, maybe you spend an hour a week in church and you watch, you know, 10 hours or more of television a week. That's going to shape the way that you think about the world. The other thing that's interesting is there seems to be a cycle where whatever is popular in terms of what people are talking about or stories that they read about in the news or things they hear at the water cooler goes on and is adapted to television. So the show Supernatural, which I now think is in its 10th or 11th season, was based on actual urban legends. But sociologists also know that the more these things are on TV, the more people tend to believe in them. So when The X-Files was on TV back in the 90s, and it's going to be on again, I guess, later this month, in those Pew Forum surveys, way more people reported belief in UFOs while the show was on the air. So television definitely does affect what kinds of things we find plausible, what we're inclined to think might have some truth to it, even if we know it's just a TV show.
Or is it the other way around? I mean, is television holding up a mirror to society and reflecting? I mean, what way does it work? Or is it a little combination of both? Television is a reflection of society, or is television informing and sort of directing that belief?
Well, that's exactly right. It's a two-way street. It's like they say, life imitates art, and art imitates life. So, you know, if you watched, you know, The X-Files back in the 90s, they were dealing with actual conspiracy theories that people were discussing on the internet and rumors about places like Area 51 and so forth. And by portraying those stories fictionally, they cause even more discussion of these events. So it is a cycle where each kind of amplifies the other.
What about the UFO phenomenon? Is there a connection? I mean, obviously, some religious leaders believe that there is a connection between UFOs, aliens, or ETs, and a demonic activity.
Right. Well, the UFO phenomenon, as a lot of your listeners may know, really begins in 1947. Right, with the Kenneth Arnold sighting, and soon everyone is talking about UFOs. And not long after that, you have people who are contactees in the 50s, and this is before the alien abductions was discussed, but said the extraterrestrials are in a spaceship and they're talking to me telepathically in my head. I can hear their voices. Right. Well, this is really very similar to other cultures where people, you know, would say the spirits are talking to me. Right. The gods are talking to me. So if you're thinking about this like an anthropologist, it's a form of possession that really begins in 20th century America. And so very quickly there were, of course, you know, conservative Christians who came in and said, well, these UFOs are real, but they're a sign of the end times, and they're demonic, and this sort of thing. And then you had other groups who said that the UFOs are space brothers, or even making, you know, claims like that Jesus had actually been an alien, and so the aliens were coming to sort of help our spiritual evolution. But it is very interesting. A lot of people have noticed the connections between possession and exorcism and demonology and other courses and other periods of time, and then looking at UFOs as a form of modern demonology or possession for our time.
Do you spend any time studying possessed objects?
Yeah, possessed objects are, you know, we've been talking about people getting possessed, but really anything can become kind of inhabited with a spirit. And I think one of the most interesting cases of this was a so-called Dybbuk box in Jason Haxton's book of the same name. And that all began with eBay, with someone selling a cabinet that they said was cursed and contained a Dybbuk, which we discussed earlier on the show as a kind of potentially malevolent spirit from a Jewish folklore. So the book is kind of describing Jason Haxton's purchase of this object and his attempt to figure out whether it's all a hoax, someone just did this for fun to create havoc on eBay, or whether there's actually something very sinister going on. And of course, he has a strange experiences we were talking about earlier with animals behaving weirdly and so forth, and is trying to figure out, is this all going on in his head? Another common object reported to be possessed is, of course, dolls. Right? There are lots of folkloric tales of possessed dolls, and these became the basis for films like the Child's Play horror movie franchise, and of course Annabelle, which is based on an actual doll owned by the demonologist Ed and Lorraine Warren. Spirits don't just have to be in people; they can definitely be in your stuff as well, and there are exorcists who can say they can get rid of possessed objects also.
Do your students come to you, do they confide in you with stories like possessed objects, or have they talked to you about having witnessed a possession or what they suspect might be a possession?
The students did not give me any sorts of, they didn't share something that was kind of over the top, right, where sort of, you have to believe me or we just, we can't have our relationship anymore as teacher and student. But I think most people, once you get them comfortable, have at least one story like that where something happened that they just really couldn't explain. And you were asking earlier about the sort of culture of academia. And of course, academics are very reluctant to suggest that anything supernatural is going on. But if you go to an academic conference and you wait till the conference is over and you go to the bar in the hotel lobby, lots of anthropologists and psychologists will talk about that one thing that they just couldn't explain that still creeps them out. So I think everybody has a good story like that.
Absolutely, absolutely. And those are the ones that just keep you coming back keeping your mind open, because when it comes from someone who is ostensibly, anyway, a person of science or has a scientific background, and then they reveal something that they can't explain or that throws them for a loop, that can be very, very unsettling, can it?
That's right. And of course, in academia, we have peer review, right? We can't really talk about things that we can't make strong, compelling, logical arguments for. So a lot of academics, if something like this happens, they just kind of put it on the back burner, right? They don't talk about it in their published work, or at least until they get tenure and have some protection. But again, right, it's very different when it happens to you. You can't always prove that these things were compelling on paper. But I think that these types of experiences have always been a part of being human, and if we don't talk about them, that doesn't mean that they don't go on.
You have another book, The Truth About Modern Vampirism, Vampires Today. What is behind, it's almost, it's a religion in some quarters, this subculture, and we're not talking about actual vampires, but people who believe they need to consume human blood, or they have an aversion to sunlight. And they'll have actual, porcelain fangs made and fitted and so forth. Is this a relatively, new phenomenon, or has it always been with us? And what's behind it?
Yeah, so my work with vampires, the so-called real vampire community, began in 2007 when I was living in Atlanta, Georgia. And most people don't know this, but Atlanta actually has a fairly built-up culture of vampires, of self-identified vampires. And a group called the Atlanta Vampire Alliance, who I eventually met and actually became friends with many of its members. And they really feel that they're not like other people, that there is something about them where to maintain their health, they need to feed on other people. So that could take the form either of drinking a little bit of blood from someone who willingly lets them drink their blood, or from, they'll say they feed just on the sort of psychic energy or the life force of other people. So in religious studies, which is my discipline, we've known about this culture for a while. We at least knew that it existed. We didn't know how many of them there were.
But let's delve further into this after the break. We'll do that, Joseph. We'll talk more about vampires right here on Coast to Coast AM. Stay with us. Always a great pleasure and a privilege to be sitting in the air chair, guest hosting Coast to Coast. When I'm not, I'm hosting my own weekly radio program out of Toronto, and it's called The Conspiracy Show. It airs Sunday nights, 11 p.m. Eastern, on Zoomer Radio, AM 740, 96.7 FM. And we also boast about three dozen affiliates in the U.S. You can listen to the live stream at zoomerradio.ca or download the free app, The Conspiracy Show, and take it with you on your mobile device wherever you go. Listen live, listen to the podcast. For more information, go to my website, strangeplanet.ca. Back with more of my conversation with Joseph P. Laycock, editor of Spirit Possession Around the World. We'll also take your phone calls. That's all coming up on Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back to Coast AM. Joseph Laycock is the editor of Spirit Possession Around the World, Possession, Communion, and Demon Expulsion Across Cultures. We'll get to your calls in a moment, but I want to talk just for a bit here, a little departure, I suppose. It may be related, but that has to do with modern vampirism and your book, Vampires Today, The Truth About Modern Vampirism. You talked about this vampire cult, I believe it was in Atlanta, but, you know, where is this rooted? Where did this, is this a modern sort of television-driven phenomenon? Where did it get its start, the modern vampire cult?
Right. Well, you know, we had assumed that this must be a religious thing. But when I actually met the vampires, a lot of them said, well, I'm Baptist. If anyone in my church found out I was a vampire, I get kicked out of church. So it's not necessarily a religious thing. For some of them, it definitely is. But others talk about it as being more of a health issue that's totally separate from their religious identity. So I did my best to sort of track down the history of this culture, but it's hard because they're a secretive bunch. And this is partly because, you know, if you were drinking human blood, you probably wouldn't want your neighbors or your boss to know about it either. So certainly back in the 70s, this culture existed, 60s and 70s, and would often form around horror conventions. So things like the soap opera Dark Shadows could be a place where you could meet other people who identified as vampires. I even found one report of the 1930s of someone who claimed they found a cult in London of people who believed they were vampires. Now, by the 1930s, the black and white Bela Lugosi movies were already out there. And if you go further back, you can read occult literature from the 19th century that talks about psychic vampires, this idea that there are some people out there who aren't back from the dead, or they don't sleep in coffins, but they'll feed on your energy. They'll suck your energy out to sustain themselves. So the idea has certainly gotten a lot bigger as vampires have gotten more prominent in popular culture, but it's older than you might think.
But for those that take vampirism seriously as a religion, is there any connection with the Church of Satan, for example?
There's a kind of, I guess you might say, a family resemblance, in that I can think of a few people off the top of my head who happen to be into vampirism and happen to be involved with the Church of Satan. Although, interestingly, if you actually read the Satanic Bible written in the 60s, one of the satanic statements is that Satanists are not going to cater to psychic vampires, right? So they're not necessarily as friendly with each other as you might think. If you go on the website for the Atlanta Vampire Alliance, they have survey data, and you can see what religion most vampires are. And actually, there's a lot more Christian vampires and even Jewish vampires than there are Satanists. So there's a connection there, but it's not everybody.
Right. You write about the New York vampire scene, which is entirely different. It's its own sort of phenomenon. And you talk about how political rivalries, for example, within the vampire community in New York City can become quite vicious. What do you mean?
Yeah, so the New York vampire scene, which I don't know as much about because I was based in Atlanta, but is very kind of traditional and having courts of vampires with titles and things like this. And so some of the people who were involved in that community in the 90s when it had kind of a heyday were sort of jaded about this and said, you know, that people would begin kind of gossiping about each other because they wanted to be have a more important role in the vampire courts or things like this. So it could get nasty, but not violent. No one was doing anything illegal, as far as I could tell. And I also had a chat once with Whitley Strieber, the author of Communion, and also the novel The Hunger about vampires, which was adapted into a movie with the late David Bowie. And he said he got that idea while sort of accidentally stumbling into an underground vampire club in Manhattan back in the 70s. So the culture's been there for a while, but it's been pretty underground.
All right, let's go to the phones, and we'll begin with East of the Rockies, and Mark is in Baltimore. Mark, how's the weather down there?
Buried in snow. Looks like we're on the moon.
I'll bet. All right, well, you're inside, I hope, safe and warm.
Yes, I am, and I want to thank you for making me a part of the program. A couple of things before I get to my two questions. Dr. Laycock, if you haven't, I would suggest picking up and reading Carl Sagan's Last Great Gift to His Students. It's a book entitled The Demon-Haunted World. You may have heard of that book.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Great. Let's see. Okay, so anyway, I have this problem where I suffer from sleep paralysis while I'm laying on my back with my eyes open, and I went to my doctor about it, and she gave me some medication to help me sleep, and that didn't really help that much. So my two questions are this. Have you heard reports of people being temporarily possessed while they're having sleep paralysis or at sleep, and can sleep paralysis be treated or cured?
Well, I'm not a medical doctor. I'm not qualified to answer certainly your second question. The first question, though, I think that really comes down to your theory of what counts as possession, right? Because every culture has their own definition of what kinds of behavior and phenomena are interpreted as spirit possession. So you're the person experiencing this. I think you're the best person to say whether or not this qualifies as possession or not, right? Don't let
me
tell you.
Visions.
What
visions where I can't move, I'm laying on my back, and I'm asleep, and my eyes are wide open. And like last week, when my eyes were wide open and I was sleeping and I couldn't move, I saw an outline around my bedroom door that I could definitely describe as like those green lines in the Matrix.
Well, that sounds terrifying, but also...
It looked like dotted lines, like my door had neon dotted lines all around it. And I was wide awake, but I was sleeping, and I was paralyzed.
Yeah, I mean, these are the kinds of stories we were talking about, right? If this happens to you, it's not a joke. That sounds pretty harrowing. I wish I could tell you more about whether or not this can be cured, but that's probably a question for medical science, not for a religion professor.
All right, Mark, in Baltimore, thanks for the call. Stay warm, stay safe. Let's go to the wild card line. Michael is in Ontario, Canada. Michael, good morning. Welcome to Coast.
Yes, good morning. Was it Joseph and Richard? My question is, a simple question. Comparing... exorcisms in the Catholic Church to those exorcisms from Bob Larson. Is one, you know, what is the, is there a proper way of dealing with exorcism? Is one more successful or refined? Or because in the Catholic Church, for instance, you deal with, they don't want to talk to the demon or anything like that. They use holy water and crosses. And Bob Larson just shouts at the demon and demands the demons to answer him.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. That's a really shrewd observation. If you watch a Catholic exorcism done properly with the Roman ritual, it's very, very different from a Bob Larson exorcism, where there's usually cameras and lots of people around and lots of thrashing and very performative. As to which one is more effective, I mean, that's ultimately a theological question, right? That's going to depend on whether you're in Bob Larson's church or the Catholic Church. I mean, one thing I can say is that if you're raised Catholic, probably a Bob Larson exorcism is not going to do much for you. On the other hand, if you were raised to believe that the Catholic Church is a false religion, you probably wouldn't take your possessed a friend to a Catholic church. So, you know, this is going to be kind of a matter of opinion, depending on which side of that fault line you find yourself on. But they're very different cultures of exorcism. You're right about that.
Well, it just seems like the priests, you know, for instance, they would like to, be more refined. And Bob Larson, his exorcisms are dramatic to the point of somebody, you know, getting involved in Taekwondo or something like that.
You're absolutely right, and I think a lot of people would say that that Bob Larson's performances can be a little bit over the top or even a little silly looking. The other thing that's interesting, you know, bringing us up, is that he does present himself as looking a lot like Father Karras from The Exorcist, even though he isn't himself Catholic. But with the clothes that he wears and the big crosses that he likes to use, so that could be another example of pop culture shaping the way that we think about things like exorcism.
Thanks for the call, Michael. It's true. The Catholic rite of exorcism, there seems to be, you know, more of a protocol there. For example, if you believe you are in need of an exorcism, you know, there's a lot of testing that's done. They have to make sure that there's not some underlying mental health issue and so forth. The Protestant rite of exorcism, the Protestant exorcism tends to be, or seems to be, far more informal.
That's right. Now, in the Middle Ages, if you went to a Catholic exorcism, there were a lot of different ways of doing it, and it wouldn't necessarily be performed by a priest. So a village in France might have someone that could exorcise you by burning candles or something like this. But when the battles broke out between Protestants and Catholics, the Protestants said Catholics are superstitious, look at these silly rituals they have. And so the church, that's when they formed up their rules. It said this is the proper way to do an exorcism, this is who can do it. And so the Ritual Romanum was written in 1614, and it's more or less the same ritual used today. It's been updated just a little bit after Vatican II. And some Protestant churches actually have pretty close regulations about how they do an exorcism. But people like Bob Larson, who are non-denominational, you know, can kind of do whatever seems proper to them. So there is a lot of variety in the types of Christian exorcisms that go on.
Has Pope Francis made some sort of an official statement regarding exorcisms?
Not to my knowledge, but groups like the International Association of Exorcists, which is a group of Catholic priests who feel that exorcism is important and should be taken more seriously by the church, have said that they really feel that Pope Francis is an ally. He's someone who's very sympathetic to what they're trying to do. And again, I talked earlier in the show about how the Pope has to do a careful balancing act between Catholics who want different things. And so I think progressive Catholics really like that he's come out about climate change and social justice and helping the poor. And I think that by being friendly to exorcists, he can kind of win some points back with the more conservative people in the Catholic Church and try to keep everybody happy that way.
All right, first-time caller Stan is in Los Angeles. Good morning, Stan. Welcome to Coast to Coast.
Yeah, good morning. First-time caller with George Norrie and you. And I've been listening to Art Bell since 85, you know, and George Norrie since he begun. I wanted to speak about Bela Lugosi, Famous Monsters, a film that I have, the first edition from the 50s. I'm 66 years old. About as old as Art Bell. I think he's a year younger than I am. But when he performed Dracula, he wrote a story in Famous Monsters of Filmland, and that there were these glaring yellow eyes in the audience.
Unfortunately, Stan, you're sort of cutting in and out, Stan. I can only make every second or third word you're saying. I don't know if you're able to hear him any better, Joseph.
I'm getting some cut out, too. I heard about the yellow eyes.
I'm sorry. We're going to have to let you go, Stan. I cannot follow the conversation. Apologies. Let's see. We have, is it Jan or Jan in Brooklyn on the wild card line?
Jan. Hi.
Hi, Jan. Welcome.
Thanks. Two parts. I was at a lecture, and he was dowsing over a shaman, and a bunch of energies jumped into me, and I was really sick from it afterwards. And I also heard from your program that if your body burns, it could be demonic possession or something. I feel like I had parts of an entity in me. Did you know about parts could be in you? Like my parts of my back have burned. It could be freezing cold outside. But healers have really made it much better. So have you heard about burning? And one other thing, I've had problems with my legs a little bit. And I woke up one day and I couldn't move. I was like paralyzed practically. And I had the worst pain imagined. It wasn't human pain. And it was just like a miracle thing. I turned on my mineral infrared lamp, and in 5 minutes, it left me. Have you heard about pain involved? And I know you could also catch this, like a friend caught it going into a farmhouse, sort of sleeping in a bed. Another friend caught it from another person. And one last quick thing. A healer told me that to spray your place with rubbing alcohol and distilled water, a combination. Have you heard about these things?
Spraying alcohol and water to do what?
Distilled water.
Distilled water?
Rubbing alcohol and distilled water.
In order to do what?
Energies.
To remove negative energy. All right.
Yeah, that's another really fascinating story, you know. And again, these are sort of real experiences involving paralysis and so forth. It's interesting if you read the Gospels where Jesus is casting out spirits. Sometimes, of course, the person it's like the exorcist, and the person is acting strange and is clearly possessed. But it also says he's casting out spirits that are making people lame, right? So I think there's definitely a precedent that things like paralysis and pain could be caused by a spirit, and there's of course lots of ways of getting rid of spirits outside the Christian tradition, and a lot of those involve using some sort of water as kind of a cleansing. So this is a really fascinating story, I think.
All right, Jan in Brooklyn, thank you for that. Wild card line again. Bobby is in Kansas City, Missouri. Bobby, welcome.
Hey, can you hear me?
I can. How's the weather down there in Kansas City?
It is cold and snowy.
All right. I hope you're safe.
I'm actually calling about sleep issues as well, except mine involve night terrors.
All right.
Pretty much all my life, I've suffered from night terrors, and it truly does feel like I'm possessed every time it happens. It's like someone else is running my body, and it is truly terrifying every time it happens. And
Do you remember what happens during the night, the next morning?
Yes. I'm pretty much awake while it's happening, but I can't control like what I'm doing.
And what do you do? Lashing out, or what are you doing?
I get up, and it's like this choking sensation. Like I always have thoughts that I'm like choking on, like different things. Like sometimes I have thoughts that, you know, like I'm choking on broken glass or sand, or sometimes it's food, even though, you know, I haven't eaten anything. It's truly terrifying every time it happens.
Is this a nightly occurrence?
I would say it's a every other night occurrence.
Oh,
my. It's been happening for years. And sleep studies are expensive, obviously, so I can't really, you know, shell out $2,000 to get a sleep study done. you know, being a working class man.
No, that is tough. I really feel for you. I can't imagine going through life like that. Listen, we'll get Charles to respond to that on the other side as we continue to discuss spirit possession around the world, possession, communion, and demon expulsion across cultures. Joseph Laycock, my guest, right here on Coast to Coast AM.